The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So today I wanted to, the topic that's kind of been on my mind, and it's a common theme for us to talk about in our practice of mindfulness is, what does it mean to meet things as they are? I kind of explored that a little bit in the guided meditation, you know, just to open to things as they are. And this is, in our mindfulness practice, this is kind of the direction that mindfulness heads. Sometimes we think of meditation practice as being oriented around picking a particular experience like breath or, you know, just staying with the breath, and we think that that's what practice means. And that's a way into practice, but that's a what we could call a tool to begin to open us to a stability of mind, a stability of mindfulness that can meet whatever's happening in the present moment. To open to just the experience of life, the experience of sound and sight and smell and taste and touch and all of the moods and thoughts flowing through. And so this opening to things as they are, being aware of what's happening in the present moment while it's happening, that can be, I mean, that's kind of a simple definition of mindfulness in a way. And opening to things as they are. We often, rather than simply opening to things as they are, we respond to or react to things as they are with views, opinions, ideas, liking, disliking, wanting to fix, wanting to change, wanting to adjust. And that area, that terrain of all of the opinions and reactions about what's happening in the present moment, that's actually a lot of where our suffering, our struggle, our difficulties arises from. And so this is why the teachings point us to looking at things as they are and noticing, okay, there's things that are happening and there's all of this stuff in the mind about what's happening. And when we can begin to distinguish the things that are happening, begin to distinguish what's arising in the present moment from the reactions, or begin to recognize, and this is kind of the place where it gets, I think it gets fun, actually, but it also is a little hard to meet this. It's where we actually see those reactions as something just simply arising as things as they are, as opposed to believing those reactions and trying to take action based on those reactions. It's like, oh, there's that sound happening and I don't like it. Well, we don't try to stop the not liking. The not liking is also something, things as they are. It has arisen. But we can know, oh, not liking, that's what's happening. As opposed to kind of believing the not liking needs to have some action taken or action followed or some stream of thoughts followed from it. So this area of our response to things as they are, how we relate to things as they are, this is a big area where we struggle, where it's kind of like our minds create this world of these opinions and views, and that's where so much of our difficulties arise. We think our difficulties, I think we often have the view or the opinion or the belief that the difficulty is about inherently what's happening, the thing that's happening. You know, things as they are, you know, what is arising, actually what is already arising, what's already here. And this is a key point I want to explore today with you, is that what we are noticing in the present moment, it's already here. It's happening. Something is happening and we don't like it, but it's already happening. That thing is already happening. So that often we think that what's already happening, that thing that's happening, that's the problem. That you know, in terms of our belief around our struggles and our suffering, we might think that whatever, the things that are happening, that's what needs to change, as opposed to, well, the fact of the resistance to that thing, or the belief that it's wrong or bad or something has to change about it, that's what the kind of the aversion or greed that we have around things as they are. So that kind of shift from believing that the aversion and greed are true, in effect, you know, that there's something that's happening and I need to do something about it. I have to fix it. I have to change it. I have to get rid of it. I have to have it. I have to hold it. Often when things are unpleasant, when things as they are unpleasant, there's an aversive reaction. When things are pleasant, there's a greedy reaction. We want to hold on to those things. We want to get rid of the unpleasant and hold on to the pleasant. And so what we begin to see, actually, and this is where our meditation kind of begins to give us an education, is that when we suppose something unpleasant is happening, maybe some of the sounds this morning, you know, the leaf blower or the backing up car. Yesterday we were in here meditating and there was a jackhammer going, you know, so some kind of intense sounds. You know, sometimes we have a sense that those are unpleasant sounds and we don't like them. And what happens when we don't like something? You know, often when it's something we don't like and we don't feel like we have any control, it's kind of like we tense up, we resist. It's like, oh, I wish that weren't happening. It's like, well, it is happening. It's already happening. And how much of the suffering that's happening in that moment is about not the sound itself, but about the way we tense, about the beliefs and views we're holding around this shouldn't be happening. This is a meditation center. Don't they know that they should schedule that jackhammering around, like, our meditation sessions? So so much of the suffering, when we start to pay attention with mindfulness, we start to see just how much contraction and difficulty and struggle comes not from what's actually happening, not from the sound, but from our reaction to it. And so this is this terrain of exploring things as they are. Essentially, there's what's happening, then there's our reaction to it. Our reaction to it is also things as they are, and so that reaction, the key point of in our practice is essentially to, rather than having these reactions being something we're kind of swirling around and buying into and believing and thinking we need to do something about, we begin to be aware, oh, these reactions too are something that's arising in the present moment. And then that simply becomes things as they are. So we have the sound of the jackhammer and we have the reaction to it. And in that exploration, so there's the sound of the jackhammer and the sound of the, and then the not liking. There's the sound of the beeper of the truck backing up and then there's not liking. That's things as they are. And what happens as we start to explore that is we begin to see, you know, that this is where the mindfulness practice begins to give us the education. We see that sometimes while we're sitting here and we're open to the sounds and we see the reactions and we know, oh, that's just not liking, we might at some point have that sound, know that sound, be experiencing the sound of the beeping or the jackhammer and not have the reaction. And then we get the visceral and experiential sense of just how much of our suffering is not happening because of what's out there, but is happening because of our relationship, our reactions to what's happening. So this is a huge part of our practice, you know, looking at exploring what's given in the present moment and what is our response to it, what is our reaction to it. so much of our, and this too we begin to see as we shift perhaps from, okay, there's the sound, and then there's not liking. As we begin to recognize, oh, not liking is something that's happening in the present moment. You know, we hear the sound, we know the sound, we experience the not liking, and we begin to get a sense of, well, what is it like to be a human being that doesn't like something? This is knowing not liking as it is. As opposed to, oh, I don't like that thing, I'm just going to bear down, I'm going to like force myself to stay with this. That's kind of buying into the not liking. It's kind of believing there's something we have to do to brace ourselves against the not liking. But rather to, oh, there's not liking happening. Well, this is a human experience. What's the experience of not liking? And often what we find with reactive emotions, both on the aversive side and on the greedy side. Now just play a little bit with this and think about it. Let's, you know, think about something that's happening in your experience that's not something you wish weren't happening, you know, something in your life that you wish weren't happening. So you know that thing that's there, that's what's happening. And can you turn to the wishing it wasn't there? What does it feel like to wish it wasn't there? That feels off. You know, there can be a contraction in the body. You know, even the face can kind of get into a contortion. Often there's some holding inside. So there's some tension. That not liking, that wishing it were otherwise, carries an impact on our system. Wishing it were otherwise kind of takes a lot of energy and kind of, you know, I think we all have a sense of certain holdings in our body that are very familiar. You know, I often did this, or I, you know, kind of tightened my back. You know, so some patterns of body that just get reinforced and reinforced and reinforced because of our reactions. So this feedback loop between our body and our mind, we can take in that feeling. What is it like to be this human being that's not liking this right now? Wow, this is what it's like. This is the impact that not liking has on the system. Or this is the impact that wanting has on the system. You know, with wanting, it's, you know, with not liking, it's actually, you know, not liking an aversion. There's some, in some ways, easier to notice the suffering of that. You know, aversion, there's the thing we don't like, and that's unpleasant. And then there's aversion itself, and that's unpleasant. So the whole suffering of the picture is like pretty clear when there's something unpleasant and we don't like it. And so we can kind of tune into that. In the side where there's something pleasant happening and we want it, you know, there's a pleasant thing out there and we want it. The thing that we want, often we are so oriented towards that. And the idea, what I think often happens is we have the idea of how great it's going to be when we get that thing. Our mind constructs a fantasy. It constructs an idea of the world with me having that thing, or that job, or that state of mind, or, you know, that relationship. You know, the mind will create a world in which we have that thing, and that's pleasant. You know, the mind will, doing that construction, it's creating a pleasant experience, and we like that pleasant experience, even though it's a complete mental fabrication. It is not real in the world. It is just our minds creating that story of, oh, how great it's going to be when I get that thing. And in that process, the wanting and the whole kind of orientation for, oh, I need that thing. That scenario is, that's where I want to be. Oh, this isn't where I want to be right now. That's where I want to be. That kind of sense of, this is not okay, I have to have that, is obscured by that whole fantasy. And so we actually miss the fact that the wanting, the feeling of this isn't okay, that's what I want. The feeling of this isn't okay is a feeling of suffering. It's an inherent dissatisfaction. As soon as we want something, there's already a sense of lack that sprung up in our experience. And that lack, play with that right now. If there's a feeling of something you don't have and that you want it, that feeling of lack, that also is suffering. It's suffering may be too strong of a word. I mean, that what we think of when we talk about suffering is often a big thing, but it's a feeling of offness, the word that we often translate in Pali for suffering is dukkha. And that word dukkha, the derivation of that word, the du part of the word means something like bad. And the ka part is related to a wheel, and I think it's understood to be the empty space in the middle of the wheel. So, you know, like the place where the axle is in the wheel. You know, where the hole where the axle goes through. And so think about what happens if you have a wheel that has an empty space that's not quite right for the wheel. Maybe it's a little off center, or maybe it's too small for the rod that goes through it. The axle hole is too small for the axle, or maybe it's too big. The ride that you get, I mean, there's definitely times when the axle, you know, that hole in the middle, when it's a bad hole in the middle of the wheel, can create tragedy. Like if the hole is too big, you know, the wheel comes off entirely and the cart crashes. But there's also times when it's just slightly off center, or maybe a little too tight, so there's a rub. Just a little ka-chunk, ka-chunk, ka-chunk. The ride is not smooth. That's the sense of dukkha. It conveys such a wide range of offness, from the tragedies of our lives to just the simple, I wish it weren't like this. So the feeling of lack that comes with wanting, it's that kind of offness, and it's a form of suffering. So what's happening in the moment? What's already happening? I've said that a couple of times, you know, that what we are aware of in the present moment is already happening. We don't actually know what the next moment will be. It's not happened yet. But this moment is already here. And we spend a lot of time resisting what is already here, wanting essentially to try to change the past. What's already here has come together through so many conditions. It's like, what's happening right now? There are so many conditions that have come into being. Just let's do a little thought experiment right now. You're all sitting in this room. How did you get here? I mean, there's the simplicity of how you got here this morning. You know, you maybe walked or drove or rode a bike to get here. So that's one way that you got here. But there's also, you know, how did you even hear about this center? How did you ever come to IMC in the first place? Those are conditions that led to you sitting here this morning. And what are the conditions that led to your even hearing about IMC in the first place? You know, was it, you know, that you happened to somebody sent you a podcast, or, you know, I don't know, you saw the center when you drove by one day. I mean, there's so many different, or maybe somebody told you about it. Somebody sent you a book. And what were the conditions for that to happen? You know, what were the conditions for that person to have decided to have sent you the book? And then there's other conditions entirely, like, you know, the weather. Believe it or not, probably some aspect of weather influenced whether you're here or not today. Maybe not today, but at some point in the past. I mean, all of the conditions, both conditions of our, you know, our in our own lives, conditions of our own choices and our own ways of being, our own upbringing, our own conditioning, how we were when we were kids. I mean, your own upbringing as a child probably contributed to whether or not you're here today. You might think of, you know, some little piece of your childhood that contributed to this. But then there's also this whole host of other things. I mean, just one example. It is probably not anybody's example, but you know, maybe how you found out about this place was by accidentally driving by here one day. You saw the sign. And maybe what happened was that there was construction on the road that you normally drive down, and so you had to turn left and come down this road instead. I mean, those conditions of that construction were not your making. So there's all kinds of conditions, both in our own making and not of our making, that come together to make this moment. It's vast. It is mind-boggling how many conditions come together to make this moment. And in fact, the Buddhist teachings say you shouldn't try to contemplate all of them because you'll go mad. You know, it's just too vast. It like branches so fast. It gets vast so fast. And yet there is something useful in recognizing and understanding that this moment has come to be based on this vast network of conditions. Partly because it helps us to understand that what's happening right now, what's already happening right now, is happening because of those conditions. It's not really entirely up to me that it's happening right now. It's such a vast network of conditions. And so again, the teachings encourage us to know that this moment has come together through this vast web of conditioning, and to look at, and because as human beings, you know, we're not automatons. We've made choices in the past. Some of those choices in the past have influenced this moment. Many of those choices have influenced this moment, as well as other things that we are out of our control have influenced this moment. But the next moment that we experience, that moment can be shaped by our choices right now. And so there is what is already happening right now, and how the next moment comes to be, what happens based on this moment, it's not just about the past. It's about the past coming together, but it's also dynamically influenced by what is happening now and our response right now. And this is how we can choose, essentially, to redirect and respond, you know, in coming today and hearing something from the Dharma. You know, it may just open your mind a little bit to, oh, there's something happening in the present moment and I don't like it. Maybe I can just know the not liking as opposed to like trying to do something with it. Right there, that's a choice in the present moment. Maybe a different choice in the present moment. So there's what's happening in the present moment. And often in our mindfulness meditation, we talk about meeting what's happening in the present moment, allowing what's happening in the present moment, essentially not trying to change what's happening in the present moment, but just opening to it, kind of like a surrender or an acceptance or an allowing. Sometimes those different words can resonate differently. Just, this is what is already. And yet often that teaching, that understanding of just open to what is. You know, what we are asked to do is really open to what already is. But that doesn't mean that we just continue to sitting there taking something or witnessing an injustice or watching something happen where some child is in danger. You know, it's like someone, if you're walking down the street with a 3-year-old and that child suddenly starts to run out into the street and there's a car coming, you don't go, oh, things as they are, you know. Just watch this. There's an action that you take because there's the movement in the heart to want to not have suffering. That movement to protect the child doesn't have to come from aversion. Now, it may well come from fear and, not wanting that to happen. But it also comes from a lot of compassion and care and the sense of that would be suffering. And so we begin to learn and we begin to explore, what does it mean to open to things as they are and begin to recognize that it's possible to act from compassion, from wisdom, from kindness, rather than our kind of habitual way of acting out of greed, aversion, confusion. Before I met the practice, I think, you know, I think, and I hear a lot as a teacher, you know, people say, well, if I didn't want something, why would I do anything? You know, it's like our whole way of acting in the world is so frequently associated with aversion and greed that we cannot think of any other way that we would even do anything. We feel like if I didn't want something or didn't want to get rid of something or I didn't think I needed to fix something or change something, then why wouldn't I just sit here like a lump, you know? What wouldn't I just be this, you know, blah being? What we start to see as we explore our minds is that there are other factors, other motivating forces in the heart. And they do feel like forces in the heart. You know, forces of kindness and compassion and generosity and patience and love and wisdom. And these forces want to act. They're not sit like a blah. I mean, it's like when we open to things as they are, you know, if you are witnessing an injustice, for instance, when the heart opens to that and feels that injustice, there may be some anger. And, you know, I'm not saying don't act, don't act because there's anger. Because there's also often when that, you know, when we encounter injustice, of course anger is going to be there. But, of course, part of it is wishing that that situation were not creating suffering in the world. And so there's both the movement of the heart to alleviate the injustice. And there's the, the movement of the heart to, no, this is wrong, this is bad. And what I'm suggesting is that with mindfulness, we can begin to, there's different ways to act in the world. And we can act from that place of anger and hatred. And that, you know, if you're acting, if you're responding to an injustice from a place of anger and hatred, it will have a certain spin as it comes out, that action. It may have a certain tone of voice. It may have a certain hostility or harshness of action. And that will have its influences in the world. If you are acting in that moment from compassion, you know, it may have a different spin. So I'm not saying, you know, sometimes I think it can be interpreted, this teaching of meeting things as they are. You know, sometimes I've talked to some people who are, you know, deep in the middle of an exploration and a life of oppression. And, you know, the sense of, yeah, I just don't know if this anger about being oppressed is going to go away. And the teaching here is not to say that that anger has to go away, but that we open to it. That too is things as they are. Open to that experience. And as we open to that, it's like maybe something new can happen. Maybe the anger won't go away. But maybe there can be a landing in that from dignity and honor that allows a different way to navigate. So meeting things as they are, opening to things as they are, to me, again, it's about what's happening, the conditions that have come together to this moment. What's happening is already happening. That's what we open to as it is. We can't change what's already happening. All of those billions of conditions have already kind of put the forces together that made this moment happen. But we do have some choice. And the mindfulness of opening to, oh, wow, this is what's happening. This is my response to it. The mindfulness of all of that creates the conditions for us to step forward into the next moment with some, perhaps, more degree of helpful action. Perhaps an action that's got more of the flavor of compassion and love than of anger and hatred. And we don't have to wait. This is something, you know, people feel like, wow, if there's anger happening and I'm acting, you know, isn't that a problem? Well, you know, sometimes we have to act. You know, if you're in a situation that's a danger to yourself and there's fear arising, it's like, well, you don't have to wait for the fear to go away to act. It's like, that's not what this teaching is saying. But it's helpful to recognize, yes, there's fear. And also to recognize that it's an act of self-compassion to act. You know, that action has both. And sometimes we can land a little bit more maybe on the side of the helpful action, you know, the helpful intention. And our mindfulness begins to open us to those more and more often. What time is it? Oh, I had a whole other section, but I think I'll stop there for now and see if there's any comments or discussion that wants to come from this. Yeah, and use the mics.
One short comment and one long
comment. I don't think it's on. Hit the button.
Okay, well, one short comment and one long comment. The short one is, one of the reasons I'm here is Gil took a class from my dad. Okay. So, yes, there are many paths to IMC.
Okay. Yes.
The longer comment, probably about 2 to 6 times a year, I come to meditation and I'm working through a situation that made me very angry. This morning, I'm dealing in the meditation with anger management. This morning, for the first time ever, I've come to insight meditation the morning after an experience that made me extremely frightened and scared. And so my meditation this morning was about fear management. This has never happened before. This also had an interesting side effect that since because of that, your talk seemed slightly less relevant to me than it normally is, I found it much easier to focus on every word you were saying. Okay? Because there were no tangents being triggered by anything you're saying about going off. And so, I've stored it away for future use when it becomes relevant, but it was actually much easier to absorb 100% instead of the usual 95% of what you say. So,
well, the fear management, as you say, you know, that's what's happening, right?
Right.
That's things as they are. And, you know, what we see is there's the management piece. Well, this is a piece I didn't quite go into. You know, that we talk a lot with mindfulness about meeting things as they are. But again, you know, even that, you know, the Buddhist teachings don't simply say, oh, just open to things as they are all the time. I mean, there's that opening to things as they are and then understanding, there's a teaching called wise effort. And, you know, when there we explore the possibility of what it means to release and let go of states that are unhelpful, like anger, fear, aversion, confusion, wanting, pride, you know, all of those reactive states. And we explore what it means to cultivate and encourage states of generosity and kindness and mindfulness and concentration. And so as we meet the present moment, we see, well, what's arising right now and what's a skillful response to that? And so that's kind of the management piece you're talking about, is that, you know, that working with what's coming up. That working with what's coming up, you know, so I just want to say this piece because sometimes it can be a little confusing. You know, we talk about taking action based on what's happening. You know, it's like, oh, there's fear arising, so what do I do with that? Okay, well, one thing maybe would be to just remind myself that the situation isn't happening right now. You know, that may create conditions for it to abate, or, you know, so making some strategies, you know, exploring what it might mean to manage that. Another strategy that is also right effort is simply, oh, this is fear. This is the experience of fear. And that's right effort in several ways. One is that, you know, wise effort has these different sides to it, and the one side is about cultivating and supporting wholesome states. And as we explore, well, what might it mean? So one kind of anger management, fear management might be, oh, what might it mean to just sit here and know what it's like to be a human being that's feeling fear? That cultivates the wholesome state of mindfulness. It cultivates the wholesome state of equanimity, of balance of mind. It cultivates some amount of concentration. It cultivates patience. It actually begins to cultivate confidence as we see it's actually okay to sit in the middle of this field. And also what it does is creates the conditions. So it's not only cultivating those wholesome states while we are exploring mindfulness. No, that the choice to be mindful, that's a choice too. That's an action that we're taking. And the the cultivating of what does it mean to be aware of fear instead of so what is it like to be a human being that's feeling fear as opposed to being like sliding down the slope of fear and getting involved in all the stories and the fantasies about it, the disaster stories about it. to instead know, oh, this is what's happening in the present moment. What we start to see as we do that is it creates the conditions to be a little more, oh, you know, it's like the fear can begin to release, partly because we're not fueling it. You know, often the sliding down that greased skid of the fear, it creates a lot of thoughts that then tends to feed back and says, oh, that's why I need to be fearful. Oh, that's really why I need to be fearful. Oh, that's going to be really, oh, no. And so the thoughts will create this like cycle that has the gas pedal on the emotion of fear. And so one strategy that mindfulness encourages or explores is essentially taking the foot off the gas pedal. And in a car, for example, as we take the foot off the gas pedal, if you're going 100 miles an hour down the freeway, if you take your foot off the gas pedal and put the car in neutral, the car isn't going to stop immediately. But you know it will come to a stop. So the condition of taking your foot off the gas pedal and putting the car into neutral creates the conditions for it to weaken, to slow down. And very similarly, that's what happens when we explore mindfulness as a strategy around fear or other unwholesome states, that it creates the conditions for it to kind of, you know, if we can hang out with it, it's like, oh yeah, that's fear. And then we kind of watch it come slowly down. The energy level of that comes slowly down. And so mindfulness itself creates the conditions for the releasing of that state. So the, you know, the mindfulness itself already as an action, when we can do it, is one of the most skillful actions as a management strategy. And yet there are times when we see that it's not easy or possible to be mindful. You know, when those states are really strong. So it sounds like your fear was pretty strong this morning in a way. It's like that the skid down to the stories was pretty fast, maybe. And when that happens, it may be that we have to take some more action than simply, oh, let's see if I can be with this fear. You know, it's like I've had this around anger, you know. Anger is probably my number one hindrance. You know, it's like the one that's my go-to hindrance. It's the one that my mind goes to when I'm not, you know, yes, it's the one that's really been practiced. And so sometimes I found, especially early in my practice, when I was just beginning to get familiar with what it meant to be mindful of these strong emotions, I would say, okay, there's anger. Let me try to be mindful of it. And phew, I'd be immediately lost in it. And so sometimes we see that the power of that reactive emotion is stronger than the power of our ability to be mindful. It's like the reactive emotion is a tsunami and the mindfulness is a little trickle of water. So, you know, if that's the case, if you see that trying to, what's it like to feel fear? You're gone immediately. Then it can be more helpful to use some other strategies. You know, maybe it's, you know, let me just see if I can take my attention off of what this topic is. Can I actually listen to the sound of the beeping? Maybe that would help. You know, it's a strong enough experience that I don't have to, that I can put my attention on it and not think about that. So, you know, redirecting the attention sometimes can be helpful. So, you know, the strategies that we use will depend on the strength of the condition and the strength of the mindfulness at the time. But mindfulness itself, when we can meet our experience with mindfulness, is one of the most powerful ways to both encourage those wholesome states and diminish the reactive states. Other comments or questions? Is there anything in your lives that this has touched that feels like, and sometimes it can be interesting to explore it from the perspective of, oh, this is what's happening for me now. Yeah, there's a mic there.
That was a really good talk, first of all. Second of all, I've been thinking a lot about like blame and negativity, and I think I really like that point about things being conditional, because then you don't really buy into your narrative.
Yes.
You know, of this is how it is, because I feel like I studied psychology, and that's so much about like objectively, you know, thinking about things and diagnosing them, and like now I'm realizing like, you know, there's so many conditions, you know. You don't, you know, and just by thinking of it a certain way, that's a condition in itself, and that affects
absolutely
it,
yes. That's know? A condition that enters into the present moment.
Right.
But I think you're right, you know, often in, you know, the self-negativity and the blame, it sounds like you are referring more to self-blame than other blame, but it, I think this arises with both. You know, it's like, you know, I'm responsible, I'm at fault, I made the mistake, you know, it's like, there's so many conditions that came together, including, you know, all of the conditioning that you had to that moment. And yet, you know, this is a really interesting and delicate kind of place, because that feeling of, oh, I did that wrong, you know, it's so easy that that goes into self-recrimination and self-blame and self-judgment and guilt. That part is not useful. You know, that part of that is simply aversion. It's self-aversion. It's like, you know, winding back on oneself. And yet there is also sometimes, it depends, not always. I mean, I've definitely felt bad and guilty about things that there was like no objective or reason at all that it was even a problem. But there are times when it's like, yeah, that wasn't such a good thing to do. I made a mistake. And it's like, I didn't know. I made the best choice I could in that moment. And I actually, you know, maybe I acted a little quickly or something, but I did, I, you know, it wasn't like I was going out to create harm, but there it is. It's like, wow, look at what happened as a result of that choice that I made. And so it's a delicate balance between, you know, taking that on and saying, wow, I was so bad, I was so wrong, and to say, wow, that look at what happened as a result of that. What did I not know? What did I not understand? You know, it's like our hearts are telling us, oh, there's something to learn here. And yet that feeling of, oh, there's something to learn here is so close and is so similar to the feeling of self-blame and self-hatred and self-judgment that it's a really delicate dance to ride that edge and to not pick it up and beat ourselves up about it. So, you know, I think, you know, in the last maybe year, for me, I mean, this has been an area of really beginning to understand that difference and seeing, wow, they are so close. No wonder it's so easy for the mind to slip there and to, like, not even want to go there, you know, to say, oh, I did that thing wrong. It's like the mind doesn't even want to go there because it so quickly goes into self-flagellation and self-hatred. But, you know, there is that edge where the mind can just say, oh, yeah, what do I need to learn from this? What did I not understand? And to be curious about that. So, you know, there's one... one teacher that teaches this four R's around reflecting around things like this. It's like, you know, first of all, she says, start with relaxing. You know, make if you're going to do this kind of reflection, make sure you're really comfortable and really at ease. You know, get yourself in a hot bath or something. Well, maybe not in California, but, you know, get yourself really comfortable and relaxed. And so let relaxation be the first place that you start from, and then reflect. Reflect back, you know, reflect on what's happened. And then maybe there's this particular incident, and then review that incident. You know, think about, okay, what happened? And be very cognizant of the fact that the mind can quickly go into the self-judgment. And if that happens, it's like, no, you know, okay, then suspend the whole project. See if you can relax. Acknowledge, you know, that part's not helpful. We're looking at this, we're looking for this other side, this other edge of, oh, what does it mean to just be curious about what I could have learned or understood there? And so reviewing. And then, you know, there may be a place, so there's relax, review, reflect, and then the fourth R is resolve. There may be, like in this one situation that happened earlier this year for me, I took an action, and it was like, wow, I had no idea that the consequences that unfolded were going to unfold. It was like there was so much suffering that happened because of a choice that I made and an action that I took. And, you know, I saw that I hadn't done it intentionally to create that harm. In fact, I had no clue. It was like this is like the conditions, right? There were so many other conditions I was completely unaware of. And my action just like was a spark that mixed with all those conditions I was completely unaware of. It's like I could see that I didn't have the intention, and I could really feel that, oh, ooh, it hurts to have caused so much harm. You know, it hurts to have had that action create so much pain and suffering. What can I learn? And it was a process of reflecting and talking to people and learning about, you know, what different things I could have done. And I learned a lot by that. I apologized to the people who were harmed, and you know, so it was a process. And the learning was around that edge of not slipping into self-recrimination. But what was so clear and amazing in that exploration was really seeing the difference. That it's a fine hair's difference. And I could rest in that feeling of, yeah, that was... There's two qualities of heart, conscience and concern, that are wholesome qualities of heart that are essentially like an ethical compass for us. And they're related to not wanting to cause harm. And they're related to a sense of, yeah, that was off. That did cause harm. I don't want to do that again. And so those qualities are worth deepening into and living our lives by, because those are our kind of ethical compass. But it's a real learning to not let it shade into the self-blame and the self-recrimination. But it's a beautiful practice and a beautiful process. So thank you for asking the question.
I think there's a lot of irony in that, because it's like you don't want to cause concern to other people, but then you're causing concern to yourself by going into it.
Yes, exactly. Much. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. And we need to stop. So thank you.